but it seemed to take forever. Father went first to the corner where a plain wooden table with a couple of chairs had been set up. I could not hear what the inspector asked him, nor could I hear any of his responses, which seemed to consist mainly of shaking his head in the negative. It was not so very long since Inspector Hewitt had charged Father with the murder of Horace Bonepenny, and although Father had never said it in so many words, he still felt a certain coolness towards the constabulary. He was quickly back, and I waited patiently as Aunt Felicity, then Feely, then Daffy, went up to speak quietly with the inspector. As each one returned to their seat, I tried to catch their eye, to get some hint of what they had been asked or what they had replied, but it was no use. Feely and Daffy both had that smarmy, sanctimonious look they get after partaking of Holy Communion, their eyes downcast and hands clasped at their waists in humbug humility. Father and Aunt Felicity were inscrutable too. Dogger was another matter. Although he had borne up well under the inspector's grilling, I noticed that he went back to his seat like a man walking a tightrope. A twitch had appeared at the corner of one eye, and his face had that strained yet vacant look that invariably preceded his attacks. Whatever it was that had happened to Dogger during the war, it had left him with an inability to be confronted close up by any sort of officialdom. "Damn the consequences!" I got up from my chair and knelt at his feet. Although Inspector Hewitt glanced in my direction, he made no move to stop me. "Dogger," I whispered, "have you seen what I've seen?" As I slipped into the chair beside him, vacated by Mrs. Mullet, he looked at me as if he'd never seen me before in his life. And then, like a pearl diver fighting his way slowly back to the surface from some great depth, he re-entered the real world, nodding his head in slow motion. "Yes, Miss Flavia. Murder. I fear we have seen murder." As my turn at the table approached, I suddenly became aware of my own heartbeat. I wish that I were a Tibetan Lama so that I could control its racing valves. But before I could think about it further, Inspector Hewitt beckoned me. He was messing about with a stack of papers and forms, waiting until I had seated myself. For an idle instant, I found myself wondering where the blank forms had come from. Woolmer and Graves must have brought them, I decided. The inspector certainly hadn't been carrying a briefcase before the performance. I twisted round for a look at his wife, Antigone. Yes, there she was, sitting quietly among the villagers in her seat, radiant in spite of the situation. "She's very beautiful," I whispered. "Thank you," he said, not looking up from his papers, but I could tell by the corners of his mouth that he was pleased. "Now then, name and address."
"Name and address? What was the man playing at?" "You know that already," I said.
"Of course I do," he smiled, "but it's not official until you say it."
"Flavia Deluce, Buckshaw," I replied rather icily, and he wrote it down.
"Thank you," he said. "Now then, Flavia, what time did you arrive this evening?"
6:40, I said, "on the dot, with my family, in a taxicab, Clarence Mundy's taxicab."
"And you were in the hall the whole evening?"
"Of course I was. I came over and spoke to you. Don't you remember?"
"Yes. Answer the question, please."
"Yes."
I must admit that the inspector was making me quite cross. I had hoped to be able to collaborate with him, to provide him with a richly described minute-by-minute account of the horror that had taken place almost in my lap this evening. Now I could see that I was going to be treated as if I were just another gawking spectator.
"Did you see or speak to Mr. Pawson before the performance?"
"What did he mean by that?"
"I had seen and spoken to Mr. Pawson on several occasions over the past 3 days. I had driven with Mr. Pawson to Culverhouse Farm and had overheard his quarrel with Gordon Ingleby in Gibbet Wood. And that was not all that I knew about Rupert Pawson, not by a long chalk."
"No," I said. "Two could play at this game."
"I see," he said. "Well,
Thank you. That will be all.
I had just been checkmated.
You're free to go,
he added, glancing at his wristwatch.
It's probably past your bedtime.
The nerve of the man! Past my bedtime, indeed! Who did he think he was talking to? May I ask a question?
You may, he said, although I might not be able to answer it.
Was Rupert, Mr. Pawson, I mean, electrocuted?
He looked at me narrowly, and I could see that he was thinking carefully about his reply. There is that possibility. Good night, Flavia.
The man was fobbing me off. Rupert had fried like a flounder, and the inspector knew it as well as I did.
Flashbulbs were still going off behind the puppet stage as I rejoined Father in the front row. Feely and Daffy were nowhere in sight. Mundy has already taken them home, he said.
I'll be ready in a jiff,
I said, walking towards the WC. No one, anywhere, at any time in history, has ever stopped a female en route to the Baffins. At the last moment, I changed direction and slipped into the kitchen, where I found Mrs. Mullet in full command. She had made a huge pot of tea and had placed steaming cups in front of Nia and Sergeant Woolmer, who sat at a side table. Nia saw me before the sergeant did, and her eyes flashed, but only for an instant, like a startled animal. She gave me an almost imperceptible shake of the head, but its meaning was clear. Women's wireless at work. I rubbed my nose casually to let her know that the message had been received. Thank you, Miss Guilfoyle, the sergeant said. You've been most helpful.
Guilfoyle? Was that Nia's name?
It was the first time I'd heard it. Sergeant Woolmer drained his cup in a single draught with no apparent ill effects. Champion tea, Mrs. Mullet, he said, closing his notebook. He gathered his papers and, with a pleasant nod in my direction, walked back out into the auditorium.
The man must have a stomach like a ship's boiler, I thought.
Now then, dear, as I was saying, Mrs. Mullet said, there's no use you going back to Culver House Farm tonight. It's raining cats and dogs, has been for an hour or more. The river will be mortal high, not safe to cross. Sides, no one would expect you to sleep in a tent in a wet field with the situation being what it is, if you take my meaning. Alf's brought a brolly that's big enough for the three of us, and we're just across the way. Our Agnes's room hasn't been slept in since she left home to take up Pitman's shorthand 6 years ago come November 13th. Alf and me have kept it a kind of shrine-like. As its own hot plate and a goose-down mattress, and don't say no, cause I won't hear you.
Nia's eyes were suddenly brimming with tears, and for the life of me, I could not tell if they were tears of grief or joy.
I'd have given a guinea to know what words passed between Father and Dogger in the back seat of the taxicab, but the simple truth is that I dropped off. With the heater turned full up against the chill of the cold night rain and the windscreen wipers making their quiet swish-swash in the darkness, the urge to sleep was irresistible. Not even an owl could have stayed awake. When Father roused me at the door of Buckshaw, I stumbled into the house and up the stairs to bed, too tired even to bother undressing. I must have fallen asleep with my eyes open.
Chapter 14. The sun was streaming splendidly in at my casement window. The birds and the chestnuts were singing their little throats out. The first thought that came flashing into my mind was of Rupert's face, his lips pulled slightly back, his teeth showing obscenely. I rolled over onto my back and stared at the ceiling. I always find that a blank screen helps clarify one's thoughts marvellously, helps bring them into focus. In death, Rupert had looked, I decided, remarkably like the dead dog I had once almost stepped on in a field behind the 13 Drakes, its fog-filled eyes staring, its yellowed fangs bared in a frozen grimace. Although with Rupert there had been no flies, and his teeth were quite presentable, actually. Somehow, the dog reminded me of something.
But what?
Of course, Mutt Wilmot, the 13 Drakes. Mutt Wilmot would be staying at the 13 Drakes. If Mrs. Mullet were to be believed, it had begun raining shortly after the evening performance began. Mutt had been there at about 6:40, say 6:45, I had seen him with my own eyes. He would hardly have set out for London in such a downpour. No, had he planned to leave, he would have done so before the show. It seemed obvious that he still had business to conclude with Rupert. Ergo, he was, at this very instant, eating bacon and eggs at the 13 Drakes, Bishop Lacey's sole hostelry. Fortunately, I was already dressed. There was a crypt-like silence in the house as I crept down the east staircase. Last night's excitement had drained everyone of their energy, and they were, I guessed, still snoring away in their respective rooms like a pack of convalescent vampires. As I was slipping out the kitchen door, however, I came to an abrupt halt. On the wooden stand beside the door, tucked between the two full bottles the milk float had left on our doorstep at dawn, was a package. It was a pustulant purple colour, with projecting top and bottom rims. The clear cellophane in which it was wrapped had protected it from last night's rain. On the lid, in gold letters, were the words "Milady Chocolates, finest assorted, £2, Duchess Selection." Wrapped around it lengthwise was a ribbon the colour of a faded red rose. The label was still attached like the Mad Hatter's hat. 10-6. I had seen this box before. In fact, I had seen it just a few days ago in the fly-blown window of Miss Cool's confectionery shop cum post office in the High Street, where it had languished since time immemorial, perhaps since the war, or even longer. And I realized at once how it had made its way to the back door at Buckshaw. Ned Cropper. Ned earned £7 a week doing chores for Tully Stoker at the 13 Drakes, and he was smitten with, among others, my sister Ophelia. Even though he had accompanied Tully's daughter, Mary, to Jack and the Beanstalk last night, it had not kept him from leaving his midnight love token on our doorstep, as an adoring tomcat drops a mouse at its owner's feet. The chocolates were so old, I thought, they were most likely full to bursting with countless varieties of interesting moulds. But unfortunately, there was no time to investigate. Reluctantly, I returned to the kitchen and stuffed the box in the top compartment of the ice cabinet. I would deal with Feely later. Ned! I gave him a smile and a wave with my fingers spread generously apart, the way royalty is taught to do. With his sleeves rolled up and brilliantined hair like a wet haystack, Ned was high atop the steep-pitched roof of the 13 Drakes, his heels braced against a chimney pot, using a brush to slather hot pitch onto tiles that looked as if they'd been up there since King Alfred burned the cakes. "Come down!" I shouted. "Can't, Flavia! Got a leak in the kitchen. Tully wants this done before the inspector shows up. Said he'd be here bright and early." "Tully says he's counting on the early part, anyhow," he added, "whatever that means." "I have to talk to you," I said, dropping my voice to a loud stage whisper. "I can't very well go shouting it up to the housetops."
"You'll have to come up."
He pointed to a ladder that leaned against the wall. "Mind your step." The ladder was as old as the inn, or so it seemed to me. It tottered and twisted as I climbed, creaking and groaning horribly. The ascent seemed to take forever, and I tried not to look down.
"It's about last night, isn't it?" Ned asked as I neared the top. "Double damnation! If I was so transparent that even someone like Ned could see through me, I might as well leave it to the police."
"No," I said. "As a matter of fact, it isn't, Mr. Smart Pants. A certain person asked me to thank you for your lovely gift."
"She did?" Ned said, his features broadening into a classic village idiot grin.
The Folklore Society would have had him in front of a cine camera before you could turn round three times and spit across the wind.
She'd have come herself, but she's being detained in her tower by her wicked father, who feeds her on floor sweepings and disgusting table scraps.
Oh, Ned said. She didn't look too underfed last night.
His features darkened as if he had only just remembered what had taken place.
Pretty sad, that puppet man, he said. I feel sorry for him.
I'm glad you do, Ned. He hadn't many friends in the world, you know. It might be nice if you expressed your condolences to Mr. Wilmot. Someone said he's staying here.
This was a lie, but a well-intentioned one.
Is he?
Dunno. All I know right now is roof, roof, roof. Sounds like a dog when you say it like that, doesn't it? Roof, roof, roof.
I shook my head and started down the shaky ladder.
Look at yourself, Ned said. You're covered with tar.
Like a roof, I said, getting a look at my filthy hands and my dress.
Ned hooted with laughter and I managed a pathetic grin.
I could cheerfully have fed him to the pigs.
It won't come off, you know. You'll still have it plastered all over you when you're an old lady.
I wondered where Ned had picked up this rustic folklore. It was probably from Tully.
I knew for a fact that Michael Faraday had synthesized tetrachloroethene in the 1820s by heating hexachloroethane and piping off the chlorine as it decomposed. The resulting solvent would remove tar from fabric like stink. Unfortunately, much as I should like to have done, I hadn't the time to repeat Faraday's discovery. Instead, I would have to fall back on mayonnaise, as recommended in the Butler and Footman's Vade Mecum, which I had come across one rainy day while snooping through the pantry at Buckshaw.
Perhaps Mary would know. Is she somewhere about?
I didn't dare barge in and ask Tully about a paying guest.
To be perfectly honest, I was afraid of him, although it's difficult to say why with any certainty.
Mary? She's taken the week's wash to the laundry, then she'll most likely be off to church.
Church? Baste me with butter. I'd forgotten all about church.
Father would be going purple.
Thanks, Ned, I shouted, grabbing Gladys from the bicycle stand. See you.
Not if I see you first,
Ned laughed, and like Santa Claus, turned to his work. As I had feared, Father was standing at the front door, glaring at his watch as I slid to a stop.
Sorry,
I said. He didn't even bother asking. Through the open door I flew and into the front hall. Daffy was sitting halfway up the west staircase with a book open in her lap. Feely wasn't down yet. I charged up the east staircase to my bedroom, threw on my Sunday dress like a quick change artist, scrubbed my face with a cloth, and within 2 minutes by the clock, barring a bit of tar on the end of my pigtails, I was ready for morning prayer. It was then that I remembered the chocolates. I'd better retrieve them before Mrs. Mullet began to concoct her dreadful Sunday ices. If I didn't, there would be a host of cheeky questions to answer. I tiptoed down the back stairs to the kitchen and peered around the corner. Something nasty was just coming to the boil on the back of the cooker, but there was no one in sight. I retrieved the chocolates from the ice cabinet and was back upstairs before you could say, Jack and the Beanstalk. As I opened my laboratory door, my eye was arrested by a glint of glassware which was reflecting a wayward sunbeam from the window. It was a lovely device called a Kipps apparatus, one of Tar de Luce's splendid pieces of Victorian laboratory glass. A thing of beauty is a joy forever, the poet Keats had once written, or so Daffy had told me. There couldn't be a shred of doubt that Keats had written the line while contemplating a Kipps apparatus, a device used to extract the gas resulting from a chemical reaction. In form, it was essentially two clear glass balls mounted one above the other, a short tube connecting them, with a stoppered glass gooseneck projecting from the top globe, and a vent tube with a glass stopcock sticking out of the bottom one. My plan took form instantly, a sure sign of divine inspiration. But I had only minutes to work before Father would come storming in to drag me down the stairs. First, I took from a drawer one of Father's old razors, one I had nicked for an earlier experiment.
I carefully slipped the faded ribbon from the chocolate box, turned it upside down, and made a careful, dead straight incision in the cellophane along the line where the ribbon had lain. A slit in the bottom and each end was all that was needed for the wrapping to open up like an oyster shell. Replacing it would be child's play. That done, I carefully lifted the lid on the box and peered inside. Perfect! The creams looked to be in pristine condition. I had suspected that age might have taken its toll, that opening the box might yield a sight similar to the one I had once seen in the churchyard when Mr. Haskins, the sexton, while digging a new grave, had accidentally broken through into another that was already occupied. But then it had occurred to me that the chocolates, having been hermetically sealed, to say nothing of the preservatives that might have been added, might still seem fresh to the naked eye. Luck was on my side. I had chosen my method because of its ability to take place at normal temperatures. Although there were other procedures that would have resulted in the same product, the one I selected was this. Into the bottom sphere of the Kipps apparatus, I measured a quantity of ordinary iron sulfide. Into the top bulb, I carefully tipped a dilute sulfuric acid, using a glass rod to make sure that the liquid went straight into the target vessel. I watched as the reaction began in the bottom container, a lovely chemical hubbub that invariably takes place when anything containing sulfur, including the human body, decomposes. When I judged it complete, I opened the bottom valve and let the gas escape into a rubber-stoppered flask. Next came the part I loved best, taking a large brass-bound glass syringe from one of Uncle Tar's desk drawers. I had often wondered if he used it to inject himself with a 7% solution of cocaine, like Sherlock Holmes. I shoved its needle through the rubber stopper, depressed the plunger, and then pulled it up again. I now had a needle charged with hydrogen sulfide gas. Just one more step to go. Sticking the needle through the rubber stopper of a test tube, I rammed the plunger down as hard as I could with both thumbs. Only 14 atmospheric pressures were required to precipitate the gas into a liquid and, as I knew it would, it worked the first time. I now had a test tube containing perfectly clear hydrogen sulfide in its liquid form. All that remained was to retract the plunger again and watch it rise up into the glass of the syringe. Carefully, I injected each chocolate with a drop or two of the stuff, touching the injection site with the glass rod, slightly warmed in the Bunsen burner, to smooth over the little hole. I had carried out the procedure so perfectly that only the faintest whiff of rotten egg reached my nostrils. Safe inside the gooey centres, the hydrogen sulfide would remain cocooned, invisible, unsuspected, until Feely. Flavia! It was Father, shouting from the front hall. Coming, I called. I'll be there in a jiff. I replaced the lid of the box and then the cellophane wrapping, giving it two quick dabs of mucilage on the bottom to tack down the almost invisible incision. Then I replaced the ribbon. As I slowly descended the curving staircase, trying desperately to look sedate and demure, I found the family gathered, waiting, in a knot at the bottom. I expect these are for you, I said, holding the box out to Feely. Someone left them at the door. She blushed a bit. And I have a confession to make, I added. All eyes were on me in a flash. Father's, Aunt Felicity's, Feely's, Taffy's, even Dogger's. I was tempted to keep them for myself, I said, eyes downcast. But it's Sunday, and I really am trying hard to be a better person. Eager hands outstretched, Feely rose to the bait like a shark to a swimmer's foot. Chapter 15. With Father and Aunt Felicity leading the way, and Dogger in the rear wearing a black bowler hat, we straggled, as we always did, single file across the fields like ducks to a pond. The green countryside in which we were enfolded seemed as ancient and as settled in the morning light as a canvas by Constable, and I shouldn't have been a bit surprised to find that we were really no more than tiny figures in the background of one of his paintings, such as the Hay Wain or Dedham Vale. It was a perfect day. Bright prisms of dew glittered like diamonds in the grass, although I knew that, as the day went on, they would be vaporized by the sun. Vaporized by the sun. Wasn't that what the universe had in store for all of us? There would come a day when the sun exploded like a red balloon and everyone on Earth would be reduced in less than a camera flash to carbon. Didn't Genesis say as much? For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. This was far more than dull old theology. It was precise scientific observation. Carbon was the great leveller, the grim reaper. Diamonds were nothing more than carbon, but carbon in a crystal lattice that made it the hardest known mineral in nature. That was the way we all were headed. I was sure of it. We were destined to be diamonds. How exciting it was to think that, long after the world had ended, whatever was left of our bodies would be transformed into a dazzling blizzard of diamond dust, blowing out towards eternity in the red glow of a dying sun. And for Rupert Pawson, the process had already begun.
"I doubt very much, Haviland," Aunt Felicity was saying, "if they'll go ahead with the service. It seems hardly right in view of what's happened." "The Church of England, Lissy," Father replied, "like time and tide, waits for no man. Besides, the fellow died in the parish hall, not in the church proper, as it were."
"Perhaps so," she said with a sniff. "Still, I shall be put out if all this walking is for nothing."
But Father was right. As we walked alongside the stone wall that ran like a tightened belt around the banked-up churchyard, I could see the hood of Inspector Hewitt's blue Vauxhall saloon peeking out discreetly at the end of the lane. The inspector himself was nowhere in sight as we stepped onto the porch and entered the church. Morning prayer was as solemn as a Requiem High Mass. I know that for a fact because we Deluces are Roman Catholics. We are, in fact, virtually charter members of the club. We have seen our share of bobbing and ducking, but we regularly attend St. Tancred's because of its proximity and because the vicar is one of Father's great friends.
"Besides," Father says, "it is one's bounden duty to trade with local firms."
This morning, the church was packed to the rafters. Even the balcony beneath the bell tower was filled to overflowing with people from the village who wanted to be as close as possible, without being unseemly, to the scene of the crime. Nia was nowhere in sight. I noticed that at once. Nor were Mrs. Mullet or Alf her husband. If I knew our Mrs. M, she would, at this very moment, be bombarding Nia with sausages and questions, plying and prying, Daffy called it. Cynthia was already on her knees, front and centre, praying to whatever gods she wanted to bribe before the service began. She was always the first to kneel and always the first to spring to her feet again. I sometimes thought of her as St. Tancred's spiritual coxswain. For once, because it would be about someone I had known personally, I was quite looking forward to the sermon. The vicar, I expected, would deliver something inspired by Rupert's demise, tasteful but instructional. "In the midst of life we are in death," was my guess. But when he climbed up into the pulpit at last, the vicar was strangely subdued, and it wasn't entirely due to the fact that Cynthia was running a white-gloved forefinger along the wooden rack that held scattered copies of the hymnary and the Book of Common Prayer. In fact, the vicar made no reference to the matter at all until he had finished the sermon. "In view of the tragic circumstances of last evening," he said in a hushed and solemn voice, "the police have requested that the parish hall be made available to them until their work is complete. Consequently, our customary refreshments, for this morning only, will be served at the vicarage. Those of you who wish to do so are cordially invited to join us after the service. And now may God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost..." Just like that. No thoughts on the stranger in our midst, such as he had delivered when Horace Bonepenny was murdered at Buckshaw. No ruminations on the immortality of the soul. Nothing. To be perfectly honest, I felt more than a little cheated.
It is never possible, at least at St. Tancred's, to burst forth from the church into the sunshine like a cork from a bottle. One must always pause at the door to shake hands with the vicar and to make some obligatory remark about the sermon, the weather, or the crops. Father chose the sermon, and Daffy and Feely both chose the weather. The swine! With Daffy commenting on the remarkable clarity of the air and Feely on its warmth. That left me with little choice, and the vicar was already clasping my hand.
"How's Meg getting on?" I asked.
To tell the truth, I'd forgotten all about Mad Meg until that very moment, and the question just popped into my head.
Did the vicar's face go slightly white, or had I just fancied it?
He looked to the left and then to the right, very quickly. Cynthia was hovering outside among the gravestones, already halfway along the path to the vicarage.
"I'm afraid I can't tell you," he said. "You see, she was..."
"Vicar, I have a bone to pick with you, you know."
It was Bunny Spurling. Bunny was one of the Spurlings of Nautilus Old Hall who, as Father once remarked, had gone to the dogs by way of the horses. Because Bunny was shaped rather like the capital letter D, no one could get past him, and the vicar was now wedged firmly between Bunny's ample tummy and the Gothic doorframe. Aunt Felicity and Dogger, I suppose, were still penned up somewhere inside the vestibule, queuing like crewmen on a sunken submarine for their turn at the escape hatch. As Bunny proceeded to pick his bone, something about tithing and the shocking disrepair of the padding in the kneeling benches, I saw my opportunity to escape.
"Oh dear," I remarked to Father. "It looks as though the vicar has been detained. I'll run ahead to the vicarage and see if I can make myself useful with the cups and saucers."
There's not a father on earth who has it in him to refuse such a charitable child, and I was off like a hare.
"Morning,"
I shouted to Cynthia as I flew past. I vaulted over the stile and ran around to the front of the vicarage. The door stood open, and I could hear voices in the kitchen at the back of the house. The Women's Institute, I decided, several of them would have slipped out of the service early to put the kettle on. I stood in the dim hallway listening. Time was short, but it would never do to be caught snooping. With one last look down the stretch of polished brown linoleum, I stepped into the vicar's study and closed the door behind me. Meg, of course, was long gone, but the afghan with which the vicar had covered her yesterday still lay crumpled on the horsehair sofa, as if Meg had only just tossed it aside, got up, and left the room, leaving in her wake, to put it nicely, a woodsy smell, the smell of damp leaves, dark earth, and something less than perfect personal hygiene. But before I could put my mind to work, the door was flung open.
"What are you doing in here?"
Needless to say, it was Cynthia. She closed the door craftily behind her.
"Oh, hello, Mrs. Richardson," I said. "I just looked in to see if Meg was still here. Not that she would be, of course, but I worry about her, you see, and..."
When you're stumped for words, use your hands. This was a dodge that had never failed me in the past, and I hoped that it would not now. I snatched at the wadded afghan and began to fold it. As I did so, something dropped with a barely audible plop to the carpet.
"I just thought I'd help tidy up, then see if they can put me to work in the kitchen."
"Drat," I said, as I let a corner of the afghan escape my fingers.
"Oh, sorry, Mrs. Richardson. I'm afraid I'm quite clumsy. We're so spoiled at Buckshaw, you know."
Awkwardly, I spread out the afghan on the floor, crouched in front of it, and began folding again. Under cover of its colourful woolen squares, and using my body to block Cynthia's view, I ran my fingers across the carpet. I felt it at once, a cold, flat, metallic object. Using my thumb as a clamp, I pressed it firmly into my palm. As long as I kept my hands moving, all would be well. That was the way the sleight of hand magicians worked. I could always pocket the thing later.
"Here, give me that," Cynthia said.
I panicked. She had caught me out after all. As she stepped into the room, I began a frantic jitterbug, kicking up my legs and throwing my elbows out like pikestaffs.
"Oh," I said, "that Afghan's making me itchy all over. I have a nasty allergy to wool."
I began scratching myself furiously, my arms, the back of my hands, my calves, anywhere, just as long as I didn't let my hands come to rest. When I got to my neck, I shoved my hand into the top of my dress and let go the object from my palm. I felt it fall inside and stop at my waist.
"Give me that," she repeated, snatching the Afghan from my hands.
I breathed a sigh of relief as I realized that she hadn't seen whatever it was I'd retrieved. It was the Afghan she wanted, and I held it out cheerily, giving myself several more hound-like scratches for insurance purposes.
"I'll go help in the kitchen," I said, moving towards the door.
"Flavia," Cynthia said, stepping in front of the door and seizing my wrist in one rapid motion. I looked into her pale, blue, watery eyes, and they did not waver. But at that instant, there was laughter outside in the hallway as the first parishioners arrived from the church. "One thing we Deleuze girls are good at," I grinned into her face as I slipped round her and out the door,
"is making tea."
I had no more intention of making tea than of signing on as a coal pit donkey. Still, I made a beeline down the hall and into the kitchen.
"Good morning, Mrs. Roberts. Good morning, Miss Roper. Just checking to see if you have enough cups and saucers."
"Plenty, thank you, Flavia, dear," Mrs. Roberts said. She had been doing this since the dawn of time.
"But you can put the eggs in the bottom of the fridge on your way out," Miss Roper told me. "The egg lady must have left them on the kitchen counter yesterday. Nothing keeps in this weather, not the way it used to, at any rate. And while you're at it, dear, you can fill that pitcher with lemonade. Mr. Spurling likes a nice glass of lemonade after church, and as he's always so generous when the collection plate goes round, we wouldn't want to get into his bad books, would we?" Before they could devise another task, I flew busily out the kitchen door. Later, when they had a moment, when they were washing up, perhaps, Mrs. Roberts and Miss Roper would remark to one another what a nice girl I was, and how unlike my sisters. Outside in the churchyard, Father still stood on the cobbled walk, listening patiently to Bunny Spurling, who was telling him, word for word, what he had just said to the vicar. Father nodded from time to time, probably to keep his neck from going to sleep. I stepped off the path and into the grass, pretending to inspect the inscription on a weathered gravestone that jutted up like a yellow tooth from a green gum. "Hezekiah Huff, 1672-1746, at peace in paradise." Turning my back on the gossiping stragglers, I extracted the metal object I had dropped down the front of my dress. It was, as I knew it would be, Nia's orange cloisonné butterfly compact. It lay cradled in the flat of my hand, gleaming softly in the warm sunlight. Meg must have dropped it while sleeping on the couch in the vicar's study. I'd return it to Nia later, I thought, shoving it into my pocket. She'd be happy to have it back. As I rejoined the family, I saw that Daffy was perched on the stone wall at the front of the churchyard with her nose stuck in Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, her latest grand enthusiasm. How she had managed to slip such a fat volume in and out of church, I could not even begin to imagine, until I came close enough to spot the neatly made tinfoil cross she had glued to its black cover. Oh, what a fraud she was! Well done, Daff. Feely stood laughing under an oak, letting her hair fall forward to cover her face, the way she does when she wants to look like Veronica Lake. Basking in her attention, and dressed in a rough wool suit, was a tall, blonde Nordic god. It took me a moment to recognize him as Dieter Schrantz, and I realized, not without a sinking feeling, that he was already completely in Feely's thrall, hanging on her every word like a ball on a rubber string, nodding like a demented woodpecker and grinning like a fool. They did not even notice my look of disgust.
Aunt Felicity was talking to an elderly person with a hearing trumpet. It seemed from their conversation that they were old friends.
"But one mustn't arch one's back and spit," the old lady was saying, curling her red-nailed fingers into a claw, at which they both cackled obscenely.
Dogger, meanwhile, sat patiently on a bench beneath a yew tree, his eyes closed, a slight smile on his lips and his face upturned towards the summer sun, looking, for all the world, like one of those modern brass sculptures called Sunday. No one paid me the slightest attention. I was on my own. The double doors in the porch of the parish hall were draped with a rope, from which hung a notice, "Police line, do not cross." I didn't. I walked round the back of the building and went in by one of the exits. It was pitch dark inside. At the far end of the corridor, I knew, was the door that opened into the auditorium. To my right were the several steps that led up to the stage. I could hear the rumble of men's voices, and although I strained my ears to the utmost, I could not make out what they were saying. The black velvet curtains that lined the stage must be absorbing their words. Unable to make any sense of the murmur, and because I didn't want to risk being caught eavesdropping, I clattered noisily up the stairs.
"Hello," I shouted, "anyone for tea?"
Inspector Hewitt was standing in a pool of light, talking to Sergeants Woolmer and Graves. At the sight of me, he broke off at once and came striding across the stage behind the puppet theatre.
"You oughtn't to be in here. Didn't you see the signs?"
"Sorry," I said, without answering his question. "I came in the back way."
"No signs in the rear, Sergeant?" the inspector asked Graves.
"Sorry, sir," the sergeant said with a sheepish grin. "I'll see to it right away."
"Too late now," the inspector said. "The damage is done."
Sergeant Graves lost the grin and his brow furrowed. "Sorry, sir," he said. "Entirely my fault."
"Well," the inspector went on, "since we're almost finished, it's not a complete disaster. But keep it in mind for next time."
"Yes, sir."
"Now then," the inspector said, turning to me, "what are you doing here? And don't give me any guff about tea."
I had learned from past experience that it was best to be frank with the inspector, at least in replying to direct questions. One could always be helpful, I reminded myself, without spilling one's guts. I was making notes upon a few points.
I hadn't made notes, in fact, but now that I'd thought of it, I realized it was a good idea. I'd see to it tonight.
"Notes? Why on earth would you do that?"
"Because I could think of nothing to say. I said nothing.
I could hardly tell the man that Dogger thought it was murder." "And now I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave, Flavia."
As he spoke, I looked round desperately for something, anything to seize upon. And suddenly I saw it. I almost whooped with joy. My heart welled up inside me, and I could hardly keep from laughing as I spoke. "Edgar Allan Poe," I said aloud, "the purloined letter."
The inspector stared at me as if I'd gone mad.
"Are you familiar with the story, Inspector?" I asked.
Daffy had read it aloud to us on Christmas Eve. "Isn't everyone?" he said. "Now please, if you'll be so good,
then you'll remember where the letter was hidden. On the mantelpiece, in plain sight, dangling from a dirty blue ribbon."
"Of course," he said, with a brief but indulgent smile. I pointed to the wooden rail of the puppet stage, which was no more than a foot above his head.
"Has the current been switched off?" I asked.
"We're not idiots, Flavia."
"Then," I said, reaching up and almost touching the thing, "perhaps we should tell the vicar we found his lost bicycle clip." Chapter 16. It was difficult, at first, to see the thing. Black metal on black painted wood was nearly invisible. If it hadn't been for the patterned spray of carbon, I shouldn't have noticed it at all. Black on black on black. I was proud of myself. The bicycle clip was pushed down over a wooden strut, as if the strut were an ankle. Beneath it ran a length of electric flex, which connected a row of toggle switches above the stage to the coloured footlights below. Even from where I stood, I could see the glint of copper wire where a section of the flex had been stripped of its insulation.
"Good Lord," the inspector said. "Whatever makes you think this belongs to the vicar?"
"Several things," I told him, ticking them off on my fingers. "In the first place, I heard him say on Thursday afternoon that he had lost his bicycle clip. In the second place, I know for a fact that it wasn't here yesterday afternoon before the show. Rupert let me have a good look round just before the matinee. And finally, it has the vicar's initials on it. Look here, if you squat a bit and look edge on, you can see them. D.R. Denwin Richardson. Cynthia scratched them on with a needle because he's forever losing things."
"And you're quite sure the clip wasn't here on Saturday afternoon?"
"Positive. I was holding on to that very spot on the railing when Rupert took me up on the bridge to show me how Galligantus worked."
"I beg your pardon?"
The look on the inspector's face was a puzzle. "Galligantus. That's the name of the giant in Jack and the Beanstalk. Here, I'll show you. Is it all right to climb up there?" I asked, pointing to the bridge.
"It's extremely irregular. But carry on."
I scrambled up the ladder to the catwalk behind the puppet stage with the inspector hot on my heels. Galligantus was still firmly in position. In the third act, as Jack is hacking away at the beanstalk, Rupert pulls this iron lever which releases Galligantus. He's spring-loaded, you see. There was a very long silence. Then the inspector took out his notebook and unscrewed the cap of his biro.
"All right, Flavia," he said with a sigh. "Tell me more."
"When Jack chops down the beanstalk, the giant's supposed to come crashing down from the sky. But he didn't, of course. Rupert did instead."
"Therefore, Rupert couldn't have operated the lever. Is that what you're saying?"
"Exactly. If he had, Galligantus would have been triggered. But he wasn't, of course, because the vicar's bicycle clip was clamped over the end of the lever, black on black. Rupert mustn't have noticed it."
"Good Lord," the inspector exclaimed, realizing what I was saying. "Then it wasn't."
"A tragic accident?"
"No, Inspector. I should hardly say so." He let out a low whistle.
"See this? Someone's cut away the insulation from this cable," I went on, "right down to the bare wire, then shoved the bicycle clip down on top to cover it. The other end of the bicycle clip is clamped over the end of Galligantus's lever."
"Forming an electrical jumper," he said. "A deliberate short circuit."
"Precisely," I said. "Here, you can see the deposit of carbon where it arced. See where the wood beneath it is a little charred."
Inspector Hewitt leaned in for a closer look, but said nothing.
"It seems to me," I added, "that the bicycle clip couldn't have been put there until sometime after the first performance. Otherwise, Galligantus couldn't have fallen."
"Flavia," the inspector said, "you must promise me you will discuss this with no one. Not a word. Do you understand?"
I stared at him for a moment, as if the very thought of doing so were highly offensive. "He was electrocuted, wasn't he?" I asked. The inspector nodded.
"Dr. Darby thinks it most likely. We'll have the autopsy results later today."
"We'll have the autopsy results? Was the inspector including me? Did he count me as part of his team?" I needed to choose my words carefully. "My lips are sealed," I said. "Cross my heart and..."
"Thank you, Flavia," he said firmly. "A simple promise is sufficient. Now run along and let me get on with it."
"Run along? What jolly cheek! What utter gall! I'm afraid I made a rude noise on my way out." As I suspected she would be, Thiele was still flirting with Dieter beneath the oaks. Father stood near the door of the church with the perplexed look on his face of a man trying to decide if he should rush to the aid of someone who has unwittingly wandered into the tiger's cage, but can't quite make up his mind about which of the cage's two occupants is in greater need of saving from the other.
"Feely," he called out at last, "we mustn't keep Mrs. Mullet waiting."
My stomach curdled instantly. Today was Sunday, the day of the week upon which we were force-fed like Strasbourg geese upon one of Mrs. Mullet's failed culinary experiments, such as stuffed sow's liver brought whole to the table and passed off as mock Denbighshire sweet loaf.
"Father," Feely said, taking the bull by the horns, "I'd like you to meet Dieter Schrantz."
Father, of course, like everyone else in Bishop's Lacey, was aware that there were German prisoners of war working in the neighbourhood. But until that moment, he had never been put in the position of having to converse with someone he always referred to, at home in Buckshaw's drawing-room, as the enemy. He offered his hand.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, sir," Dieter said, and I could see that Father was taken aback by Dieter's perfect English.
But before he could respond, Feely fired off the next round.
"I've invited Dieter to tea," she said, "and he's accepted."
"Providing you approve, of course, sir," Dieter added.
Father seemed flustered. He pulled his spectacles from his waistcoat pocket and began polishing them on his handkerchief. Fortunately, Aunt Felicity arrived in time to intervene.
"Of course he approves," she said. "Haviland's never been one to hold a grudge, have you, Havvy?"
Like a man in a dream, Father looked round him and remarked, to no one in particular,
"Interesting weather."
I took immediate advantage of his momentary confusion.
"Go on ahead without me," I said. "I just want to pop in and make sure Nia's all right. I'll be home directly."
And no one lifted a finger to stop me. Mrs. Mallet's cottage was nestled at the far end of Cobbler's Lane, a narrow, dusty track that ran south from the high street and ended at a stile. It was a cosy little place with hollyhocks and a ginger cat dozing in the sun. Her husband, Alf, was sitting on a bench in the yard, carving a willow whistle.
"Well, well," he said when he saw me at his gate, "to what do we owe this most prodigious great pleasure?"
"Good morning, Mr. Mallet,"
I said, falling effortlessly into my best prunes and prisms voice.
"I hope you keep him well."
"Fair, fair to troublesome digestion. Sometimes kicks like a kangaroo, elsewise burns like Rome."
"I'm sorry to hear that," I said, meaning every word of it. We Deluces were not the only ones subjected to Mrs. Mullet's culinary concoctions.
"Here,"
Alf said, handing me the wooden whistle. "Give her a blow. See if you can fetch up an elf." I took the slender piece of wood and raised it to my lips.
"Perhaps I'd better not," I said. "I don't want to wake Nia."
"Ha," he said, "no fear of that. She's gone afore the sun."
"Gone?"
I was astonished.
"How could she be gone?"
"Where?"
I asked.
"God only knows,"
he shrugged.
"Back to Culver House Farm, maybe. Maybe not. That's all I know. Now give us a toot."
I blew into the whistle, producing a high, shrill, piercing wail.
"Wizard tone," I said, handing it back.
"Keep it,"
Alf said. "I made it for you. I thought you'd be round before long."
"Smashing,"
I said, because I knew it was expected of me. As I walked back to Buckshaw, I thought how similar my life was to the lives of those swarming clerics in Anthony Trollope who seemed to spend their days buzzing from cloister to vicarage and from village to the bishop's palace like black clockwork beetles scuttling to and fro in a green maze. I had dipped into the warden during one of our compulsory Sunday afternoon reading periods and followed it a few weeks later by skimming bits of Barchester Towers. I must confess that, since there was no one of my own age group in his writings, I did not care much for Trollope. Most of his fossilised clergymen, for instance, quite frankly made me want to spew my sausages. The character with whom I most identified was Mrs. Proudie, the tyrant wife of the rabbity bishop, who knew what she wanted and, for the most part, knew how to get it. Had Mrs. Proudie been keen on poisons, she might have become my favourite character in all of literature. Although Trollope had not specifically mentioned it, there was no doubt in my mind that Mrs. Proudie had been brought up in a home with two older sisters who treated her like dirt. Why did Ophelia and Daphne despise me so? Was it because Harriet had hated me, as they claimed? Had she, while suffering from the baby blues, stepped off into thin air from a mountain in Tibet? In short, the question was this. Had I killed her? Did Father hold me responsible for her death? Somehow, the sparkle had gone out of the day as I plodded glumly along the lanes. Even the thought of Rupert's murder and its messy aftermath did little to cheer me. I gave a couple of toots on the willow whistle, but it sounded like a baby cuckoo fallen from its nest, crying woefully for its mother. I shoved the thing into the bottom of my pocket and trudged on. I needed some time alone, some time to think. Seen from the Mulford gates, Buckshaw always had about it a rather sad and abandoned air, as if some vital essence were missing. But now, as I walked along beneath the chestnuts, something was different. I spotted it at once. Several people were standing on the gravel sweep in the forecourt, and one of them was Father, who was pointing at the roof. I broke into a run, dashing across the lawn like a sprinter, chest out, fists going like pistons at my side. I needn't have bothered. As I drew closer, I saw that it was only Aunt Felicity and Daffy, both standing on one side of Father, with Feely at the other. At her right hand stood Dieter. I couldn't believe my eyes. Feely's eyes were sparkling, her hair was shining in the summer sun, and her smile was dazzlingly perfect. In her grey skirt and canary-yellow sweater set, with a single strand of Harriet's cultured pearls draped round her neck, she was more than vibrant. She was beautiful. I could have throttled her. Ruskin found square drip mouldings abominable, Father was saying. But he was being facetious, of course. Even the best of our British sandstone is but a pale mockery of the fine-grained marble one finds in Greece. Quite true, sir, Dieter agreed. Although, was it not your Charles Dickens who thought that the Greeks used marble only because of the way it took paint and colour? Still, the style and the material mean nothing when the moulding is placed under a portico. It is the architect's joke, isn't it? Father considered for a moment, rubbing his hands together behind his back as he stood staring at the front of the house. By Jove, he said at last, you may have hit on something. Ah, Flavia, Aunt Felicity said as she spotted me. Think of the devil and she shall appear. I should like to paint presently and you shall be my assistant. I relish the brushwork, but I simply can't bear the sticky tubes and the dirty rags. Daffy rolled her eyes and edged slowly away from her mad old aunt, fearing, I think, that she was going to be put to work as well. I relented enough to ask her one question. There were times when curiosity trumped even pride. "What's he doing here?" I whispered into her ear, giving a slight tip of my head towards Dieter. Of course I already knew, but it was a rare opportunity to talk sister to sister without rancour. Aunt Felicity insisted, said he should walk us home and stay to tea. I think she's got her eye on him, she added with a coarse snicker. Although I'm quite accustomed to Daffy's excesses, I must admit that I was shocked. For Feely, she explained. Of course, no wonder Father was exercising his rusty charm. One daughter fewer would mean a one-third reduction in the number of surplus mouths he had to feed. Not that Feely ate that much, she didn't, but coupled with a similar reduction in the dose of daily insolence he would need to put up with, palming her off on Dieter was well worth the effort. Then, too, I thought, there would be an end to the vast outlays of cash for the constant re-silvering of Buckshaw's looking-glasses. Thieley was hell on mirrors.
"And your father?"
Father was saying to Dieter. I knew it. He was already greasing the skids.
I believe you said something about books.
He's a publisher, sir, Dieter said. He's the Schranz of Schranz and Markel. You may not have heard of them, but they publish in German editions of...
Of course! The Luxus Ausgaben, Schranz and Markel. Their Pliny, the one with the Dura plates, is quite remarkable.
Come along, Flavia,
Aunt Felicity said.
You know how tiresome it is to paint brickwork once it's in shadow.
From a distance, I must have looked like a sinking galleon as, with Aunt Felicity's easel over my shoulder, a stretched canvas under each arm, and a wooden box of paints and brushes in each hand, I waded barefoot through the shallow waters of the ornamental lake towards the island upon which the folly was situated. Aunt Felicity brought up the rear, carrying a three-legged stool. In her tweed suit, floppy hat and smock, she reminded me of photos I had seen in Country Life of Winston Churchill dabbling with his paints at Chartwell. The only thing missing was the cigar.
I've wanted for ages to render the South Front as it was in the days of dear Uncle Tar, she shouted, as if I were on the far side of the world. Now then, dear, she said, when I had finally set up the painting gear to her satisfaction. It's time for a quiet talk. Out here, at least, we shall not be overheard, save by the bees and the water rats.
I looked at her in astonishment.
I expect you think I know nothing about the kind of life you lead.
This was the sort of statement of which I had learned to be exceptionally wary. Its implications were immense, and until I saw which way the conversational wind was blowing, I knew that it was best to keep quiet.
On the contrary, she went on, I know a great deal about what you must feel, your loneliness, your isolation, your older sisters, your preoccupied father.
I was about to say that she must be mistaken when I suddenly saw that the coming chat could be turned to my advantage.
Yes, I said, staring off over the water and blinking as if to stop a tear. It can be difficult at times.
That's precisely what your mother used to say about living at Buckshaw. I remember her coming here summers as a girl, as I had before her.
Picturing Aunt Felicity as a girl was not an easy task.
Oh, don't look so shocked, Flavia. In my youth, I used to run wild here on the island like a pawny princess. Moonu Tanawa, I called myself. Pinch nice bits of beef from the larder and pretended I was cooking dog over a campfire lighted with rubbing sticks and snuff. Later, even in spite of the great difference in our ages, Harriet and I were always the greatest of chums. The wretched outcasts, we used to call ourselves. We would come out here to the island to talk. Once, when we hadn't seen one another for a very long time, we sat out all night in the folly, wrapped in blankets, jabbering away until the sun came up. Uncle Tar sent Pierpoint, the old butler, to bring us plasmon biscuits and calf's foot jelly. He had spotted us from the windows of his laboratory, you see, and...
What was she like? I interrupted. Harriet, I mean. Aunt Felicity made a dark slash of colour on her canvas, which I guessed was supposed to represent the trunk of one of the chestnuts in the drive.
She was exactly like you, she answered. As you very well know.
I gulped.
She was?
Of course she was. How could you not be aware of it?
I could have filled her ears with the horrid tales that Thieley and Daffy had told me, but I chose not to. Zipped lips save ships.
Dogger had said that to me once when I asked him a rather personal question about father.
Zipped lips save ships,
he had answered, turning back to his deadheading, and I hadn't the nerve to ask which of the three of us were the mutes and which the vessels. I had mumbled something unsatisfactory then, and now I found myself doing it again.
Good heavens, child!
If you want to see your mother, you have no more than to look in the glass. If you want to know her character, look inside yourself. You're so much like her, it gives me the willies.
Well, then.
Uncle Tar used to invite us down to Buckshaw for the summer, she went on, either unaware of or choosing to ignore my burning face. He had some extraordinary idea that the presence of young females in the house held it together in some abstruse chemical fashion, something about bonds and the unsuspected dual gender of the carbon molecule. Mad as a March hare, Tar Deluce was, but a lovely old gentleman, for all that. Harriet, of course, was his favourite, perhaps because she never grew weary of sitting on a tall stool in that stinking laboratory and taking down notes as he dictated them. My whiz-bang assistant, he used to call her. It was a private joke. Harriet told me once that he was referring to a spectacular experiment gone awry that might have wiped Buckshaw off the map, to say nothing of Bishop's Lacey and beyond. But she swore me to silence,